Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network. Are you worried about democracy? I have to confess, I am a bit worried about democracy. That's why I listen to a wonderful podcast called Democracy Works. It's run by the fabulous people at the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State University. The podcast aims to rise above partisan politics and the daily news grind to take a broader look at issues impacting democracy. These are things we cannot ignore. You can go to www.democracyworkspodcast.com and subscribe in all kinds of ways, or you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and many other places. We really love this podcast at the NBN, and so much so that we are going to provide you with a little taste of what you can get at Democracy Works. I hope you enjoy the following episode.
From the McCourtney Institute for Democracy and the studios of WPSU on the campus of Penn State University, I'm Michael Berkman.
And I'm Chris Beam, and this is Democracy Works.
Season 3, Chris.
Yeah, who'd have thunk it?
Who'd have thunk it? Yeah.
Well, we want to just, you know, take a minute and say thank you to all the folks who around the world, really, who are listening. And we appreciate your interest and your support, and glad to be out here for another season.
Yeah, absolutely. And let us know how we're doing and what you'd like to hear us talk about. And
absolutely. Yeah,
we really want more.
Yeah,
we want more feedback.
Right, absolutely.
And, yeah. So we're starting an exciting new partnership this year, Chris.
With WPSU, right. And as you—
The Emmy Award winning WPSU.
That's right. That's right, yeah. And we've been here all from the beginning, but we've kind of up the ante on both sides in terms of our relationship, and it bodes well for both of us, I think, moving forward.
Yeah, I think it's much to our benefit to be to be working with the professionals at WPSU.
Yeah,
it can only help us.
Yes, exactly. they both, yeah. You know, we always say that Jenna makes us sound smarter than we are, and WPSU makes us sound better than we do.
So, Chris, we're starting season 3 with a really appropriate topic, and that is, what is democracy?
Right. We were fortunate enough to bring in Astra Taylor, who is an activist, a writer, a musician, and most relevantly, a filmmaker. Her film, What is Democracy? By the time this podcast releases, it will be premiering in Chicago and New York. We heard about it at the Toronto Film Festival in the summer of 2018, and through the work of folks at Penn State, we're able to bring her in.
Yeah. She starts with, you know, a very interesting question, a very important question, one that we've posed ourselves to students around campus and at various events that we've been at, and that is, it just, you know, what do you think democracy is?
Right. And her, you know, she argues that, you know, democracy is this really amorphous term, and everybody kind of has this, you know, largely good feeling about it, but nobody really kind of can articulate, or many people cannot articulate, what it means and just as importantly, what it requires of us, right? I mean, what does it mean to be part of a democracy? What does it mean to be a citizen in a democracy?
Right. There are many really valuable points that come out of this film. Two that strike me is one that democracy evolves. Mm-hmm. Democracy is often not at all inclusive, which seems like a complete contradiction.
Well,
in terms.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
But our own democracy started with slavery,
mm-hmm.
and so obviously it's an incomplete democracy. And our democracy has grown over time. It has become more all encompassing. But a point that she makes is that democracy is often quite limited in terms of who it embraces. And I think the second important point that she makes concerns the challenges for maintaining democracy in capitalist societies, especially global economies.
Right. So, the first part, your first question of who do we mean? When we say we the people, who's we? When we say all men are created equal, who is all men? What does that mean? And you could write American history as being the slow and painful and struggle of expanding that definition, right? But when at the point of the founding, it was all men meant all white property holding men. And that was it, right? And so over time, you've expanded that definition. But there's still many people who don't feel like they're included.
Yeah, there's a natural tension between capitalism and democracy because capitalism leads to inequality and then democracy sort of celebrates equality in all voices. But I think thought about even more subtly, it presents a challenge in this way, and that is that politically elected leaders are dependent upon the functions carried out by the capitalist, by those who are leaders in the capitalist economy.
Well, and the film pushes it back even farther than that, right? It goes back to ancient Greece, and there's a lot of quotes from Plato. Plato, by many regarded to be the first Western philosopher, thought that democracy was completely unsustainable for these very reasons. But, I think the fact that we're going this far is a good reason to stop and bring in Astra and Jenna.
This is Jenna Spinelli here today with Astra Taylor. Astra, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we are excited to talk with you about your film, What is Democracy?, which is a big question to tackle in a documentary, but certainly explore it from many different angles. I heard you mention in the film that you maybe had not intended to make a film specifically about democracy, but it was something you kept coming back to. I'm curious what you had intended to do and what was it about this question of democracy that kept you coming back to it?
Yeah, in the film, I thought it was important to include my sort of grappling with the film's theme, right? So I think when I embarked on the project, I started filming it at the end of 2015. I actually wrote the first email to my producers suggesting the idea in 2013. I actually thought, well, maybe I'll come up with something beyond democracy. Maybe I will come to the conclusion that we need something new, a new word, a new concept, a new way of organizing our social life. And yet, as I say in the film, I kept coming back to democracy. And I think for me, the big takeaway of making this film and writing the companion book that goes with it is I've actually become more of a small d Democrat. It's sort of inspired a deep conviction in the concept, in the practice, and things that bothered me about the term, its vagueness. What does it mean, right? All sorts of people say that they believe in democracy. I mean, North Korea has the word democratic the People's Republic?
People's Democratic Republic.
People's Democratic Republic. Yeah. And my anarchist friends, praise democracy. George Bush was bringing democracy to Iraq, right? But it's vagueness, I think. A few years ago, I thought, okay, well, this is a sign that this word has no core meaning. It has no essence. But now I actually see its ambiguity as part of its power because it's this promise that we can keep trying to fulfill.
Mm-hmm. So you said you've kind of come to see yourself more as a small D Democrat? I would have said you were a small D Democrat long before that, you know, back to Occupy Wall Street and, you know, even perhaps before that. I'm curious, how did that kind of evolution happen in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, I think, though, I think I didn't find the word democracy very exciting. It wasn't rousing. I mean, there's a sense that democracy is, I mean, that it was corrupted, that it was synonymous with bureaucracy. Right. So I would have been more attracted to words like freedom and equality and justice and even socialism or revolution. Democracy is, I mean, people like us are interested in it and make films about it and have podcasts about it. But I don't think it's a word that most people think is exciting. And, you know, in fact, I'm more typically a writer than a filmmaker. I haven't made a film in 10 years. And when I told my literary agent I wanted to write a book about democracy, she was just like, oh, God, you know, that sounds like a boring civics lesson and you're going to kill your career. And like that, she was just like, wake up. That is not a word that inspires people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and things have really changed. I think we're in a really different political moment than when we had that exchange, because right now we're in a moment where people are feeling that there's a profound political crisis and feeling like, you know, a democracy that they took for granted is in decline. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we're actually seeing people sort of feeling like, oh, gosh, I better pay attention to this thing that I was ignoring.
Right. And did you see some of that play out in the course of making the film? You know, you said you started in 2015, 2016 and kind of continued. Did it continue on after the 2016 election? Or
no, the last week of filming was the 2016 election. Okay. I filmed for a few days after Trump's victory, and like most people, I was surprised. I filmed at a Trump rally in North Carolina, and I had attended one maybe 2 weeks prior, and that was sort of my first, just on a sort of being surrounded by his supporters in, you know, rural North Carolina. There was this sense I sort of went home and couldn't sleep, and I was like, I think things are not as safe as I anticipated that they were. But I had that as sort of the horizon, that the point at which I would stop shooting. So I think people got more concerned with democracy. They got more sort of panicked. And yet, you know, I think what's interesting about the film and how it turned out in the editing room is actually the footage that I shot earlier was somehow more powerful. It didn't lose its relevance because so many problems existed then. They've existed for decades, or as the film tries to show, for millennia. So it's not, and in fact, the closer we got to this sort of moment of crisis of the election, actually I found that people almost couldn't think. The interviews weren't as good because people were just in the state of panic that was not very philosophical, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, coming, kind of like uncovering these issues that had been there all along. People just hadn't been thinking about talking about.
Yeah, and so I mean, I was pursuing political, you know, themes in my interviews, and so the things that people were raising in 2015, you know, are still relevant. And in a way, they're sort of the cause of the crisis that we're now in. And in all of my work, whether it's my writing or my filmmaking, my temperament is always to emphasize continuity and to sort of put change in its place. So I wrote a book called The People's mm-hmm. Platform that's about, the digital revolution. And, you know, my thesis in the introduction is that we've downplayed continuity, that actually the problems with our communications, our sort of digital communications, are actually the problems that existed in the old media landscape. So consolidation, commercialism, these are problems that have carried over.
Sure.
Right. And so when we sort of say there's been a revolution or talk about the sort of novelty or are astonished by the fact we have, you know, a tiny computer in our pockets, mm-hmm. we're ignoring these sort of bigger trends that are these longer trends that are really essential. And so the film, you know, has a sort of similar approach in the sense that it's like, yes, something unprecedented has happened, but also you can see similar dynamics throughout history. And so the film goes back to Plato and the Republic mm-hmm. and warnings about the demagogue.
Mm-hmm. And you ask several people in the film questions that we've been asking, that, you know, what does democracy mean to you? And when I've asked it, I've gotten everything from the patriarchy to volunteering at nonprofits. And you also got a whole range of responses to that question. And, you know, people brought up freedom and justice and equality and I'm wondering if the fact that democracy is something that people can kind of project all of these different things onto, is that a good thing? Or, you know, how does that kind of help us get to a shared definition of yeah. you know, what it is?
I think the fact people have different answers is a good thing. But I actually, I didn't find that people had answers that were particularly in depth. And actually, nobody said democracy was equality to me. Hmm. That was a word that I sort of expected to hear. But it wasn't something I encountered. So I got a lot of, I found that when I really engaged people and started asking, they could have quite interesting things to say about their lives and the political situation. But when I posed directly the question, what is democracy, their answers could be kind of cursory or there could be platitudes. And I think that's a sign that, like, that's a symptom that something is wrong, right? That people can't really robustly or personally explain this concept that is supposedly so essential to our society, right? And I think part of the problem is that democracy isn't something people really do a lot of, you know, and we hold up elections. So, yeah, you have your, you know, trip to the voting booth, or maybe you have the sort of fleeting euphoria of a street protest. But I don't think democracy is something people really feel they experience day to day. And that's part of why I think people have a hard time defining it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talk all the time on the show about, you know, democracy is hard work. It's going to meetings. It's having conversations with people you might not agree with, and, you know, trying to have a sense of empathy, you know, trying to understand where other people are coming from. So one thing I did not hear expressed in the film was this notion of classical liberalism. So norms, institutions, those kind of things. Did that factor at all into your thought process in you putting the film together?
Yeah, I mean, I think at different points there was a lot more about the rule of law and sort of thinking about, because I thought about different sort of tensions in democracy as I was going into it, and so on, was sort of like rule of law or the rule of the people, right? So sort of, you know, that it just didn't end up being the most sort of compelling issue. So there is stuff. I mean, there's stuff about sort of structure. Nobody uses the word norms, but there's stuff about structure and rules woven throughout the film, you know, and sort of who writes the rules. And, you know, Reverend Barber talks about attacks on voting rights. You know, and at one point, Wendy Brown made a more sort of direct comparison between sort of liberalism mm-hmm. and a sort of Rousseauian vision of popular sovereignty. But, you know, all of my test viewers were like, my eyes are glazing over.
Right.
And, you know, liberalism is as hard to define as democracy is. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a big and vague mm-hmm. concept there, too. So everything was like a can of worms. You know, it was like I'd throw in a word and be like, oh, my God, now I have to go and define this. So I think this, the issue of structure is there, but it's implicit. And, you know, and the one person who sort of makes the case for not really norms, but the rule of law is an Afghan refugee mm-hmm. who's saying, you know, yeah, we need to have systems. We need to have systems of punishment. Like, you know, we can't just have, you know, total freedom or even some romantic idea that if we are free, we'll just collaborate and it'll all be great. So, I mean, part of my attempt also was to raise sort of these fundamental issues, but in language that's not necessarily the typical academic or philosophical language. Because when regular people, meaning just, you know, we're all regular people, but meaning non-experts, meaning those of us who don't, you know, read and engage the scholarly literature, I mean, people bring up these issues, they just don't use the academic or philosophical or, you know, left-wing rhetoric. Mm-hmm. So I think I feel like it's sort of hinted at, but it's just in sort of, yeah, common tongue.
Do you have a sense of like where the line between democracy and populism is? I think kind of like, you know, absent some of the, you know, liberalism and, you know, rule of law type of things, there's kind of a slippery slope.
Yeah, I'm still thinking through the term populism because I think there's a lot of right now, that's also another word, like liberalism and like democracy. There's a huge literature around it and it's sort of up for debate. And I think there's a battle over different definitions of populism, and there are attempts to claim populism on the left and the right. I think the right is making a much more successful pitch. I've noticed actually a lot of conservative intellectuals actually calling themselves now populists, and which is interesting. So, you know, this idea of popular sovereignty is in the film, right? That, okay, if, by its classical definition, democracy is the people ruling. But I didn't get into, okay, well, when does that slip into populism? Mm-hmm. And I have to say, there's a way in which the word populism is being used now mostly by liberals that's bothering me. And it's basically the sort of thing of tarnishing people on the far right and the far left as populists equally. And in fact, I've been sort of tarnished as a populist by a very prominent liberal writer, as though I was like the double of Steve Bannon because I organize debtors. I basically, you know, when I'm not making films or writing, I organize around student debt and try to, you know, help people have fair terms or get debt abolition if they've gone to fraudulent, like, predatory colleges. You know, I'm not, I don't know. I mean, so that's where I start to worry that the term has kind of lost some of its, you know, lost some of its purpose or
yeah, kind of the Steve Bannonization of it, or yeah, kind of
yeah.
taken over.
Well, I mean, it just can't be a synonym for everything we don't like, you know, whether it's coming, whatever side it's coming from. So I'm trying to figure out what the proper role is. I mean, you know, I think America has a very interesting tradition of like capital P populism that was a specific, you know, historical political movement. But I'm still wrestling with what that word means in this moment, and it's not something I would define myself as. So when somebody says I fit in it, then I go, what's going on?
the film, as it's coming to an end, Cornel West talks a little bit about Dostoevsky's paradox. Can you explain what that is? I think that's kind of relevant too in this argument about the hard work of democracy and why people might not necessarily be inclined to do it outside of things like voting or those kind of momentary.
Well,
things.
I mean, the question, the film is trying to look at some of the structures that are preventing democratic processes and expressions. You know, so there's a lot in the film about the role of finance and the power of markets and, you know, and sort of minority rule. You know, but then at the end of the film, I ask the question, which is, you know, well, do people want to rule themselves? I mean, do people want to be free? And I think that, you know, it's a tough question. I mean, philosophers have, you know, existentialists have long talked about the sort of abyss of freedom and the fact that people retreat from it or flee from it. And you know, I think the thing is, there's, you know, as Cornell says, there's a lot of evidence on the sort of negative side of the ledger, right? That, you know, people don't want to be free, that, you know, democratic processes have enabled sort of, you know, the rise of fascism and all sorts of unappealing things. And yet, on the other side, lo and behold, a lot of great ideas have come from below, right? I mean, a lot of the principles and the progress that we value have come from people who we might think we shouldn't trust. So, you know, I think that tension is really fundamental. You know, and I think as a woman, right, if you go back and you sort of read the historical record, and there's all these, you know, smart guys saying we can't let women have the vote. I mean, they're just so irrational. And by the way, the husband has them covered. It's all good, you know. And you think, okay, well, then that means that, you know, not that long ago I was part of this, you know, untrustworthy mob. So who am I to project onto people that they can't be trusted today?
The film also spends a good amount of time talking about the notion of inequality, economic inequality, racial inequality, and there's certainly lots of folks saying we can't really fix what's wrong with democracy until we solve these other issues of inequality. Did you gain any understanding through the course of making this film about how we might do that, what some of the steps to take might be? I know it's one of those questions that's like so hard that like it's, you know, hard to even know where to start to tackle it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely of the mindset that you cannot have political equality, that people can't enjoy the political rights that they have on paper under conditions of extreme inequality, right? So the question, though, of how to rein in the engines that are producing these conditions and this immense concentration of wealth. I mean, it's a real challenge. So I think part of the film is, and that's the work I do as an activist. So the work around debt is looking at what I'm really trying to do with my colleagues at the Debt Collective is open up a new avenue to fight inequality. So there have been labor unions for, you know, a long time fighting for economic reform by using the workplace as a site to build power. So the idea that we're operating on is that debtors can also organize and use their debts as a form of asset. And debt is an asset. And so you can use that as a form of power to advocate for change. And, you know, there's things about debt that make it hard. So, for example, debtors don't share a workplace. But then the upside of that is that these conditions of indebtedness also bond people who live in different areas. So it's something that sort of transcends the urban and rural divide and unites people of different races and genders and ages. so, you know, but it's a challenge. How do we get people to go from their personal condition of, you know, having to go into debt because they're not paid enough or because they don't have access to affordable education or healthcare, and then create a strategy that can then, you know, produce a change within the financial system or the state when those structures are also embedded in a global economy. So the film is, you know, trying to honor how immense the challenge is right now. But I think, you know, the answer is organizing, right? And that's, you know, we know that, you know, the period of relatively equal income distribution coincided with there being strong labor unions and, you know, a different sort of economic, you know, New Deal influenced international system. So, you know, we have to change the structures, and to do that, people have to be organized.
Right. So as we kind of start to bring things to a close here, you mentioned earlier that you have a companion book to your film coming out. So where does the book pick up?
Yeah. So I think, I don't know how other people edit movies without having this idea in their mind that it's okay, it can all go in the companion book, because otherwise you have to kill all your darlings. The book makes explicit a lot of the things that are implicit in the film. I mean, cinematic language and book language, if that's what it's called, they're just very different. I mean, and it's also just I approach them in a really different way. The film for me is a space to let people speak, and there's this kind of politics of listening to the film that really matters to me. It's you know, I'm able to show people who we might not assume are experts in democracy and show them, you know, alongside quotes from Plato and to kind of, you know, create this sort of democratic chorus that I think is, to me, I still find it powerful to see these young women, you know, sort of take the stage. And older women, too. I mean, all sorts of people who, you know, we don't often see in you know, philosophical films, if we see philosophical films, actually. Each chapter of the book is about a sort of paradox or tension that I think will, you know, be with democracy as long as we have something that resembles democracy or is moving towards democracy. And it's really about the fact that, you know, it's a process that's unending and is and requires a lot of attention and a lot of work.
Yeah. Can you give us an example of what some of those paradoxes are?
Yeah. So one paradox is structure versus spontaneity, coercion versus consent or choice. One is, you know, so there's also the tensions of space, the local versus the global, and of time, the present versus the future. And, you know, there's a lot in the book that will be familiar to people who do political science and political theory, but I'm hoping that by putting these tensions sort of front and center, it provides a sort of new perspective on these issues. And, you know, in line with the film, it mixes voices. So there's sort of voices from below and voices from above and voices from history and voices from now. And I think, you know, the form and of the book is, you know, a pretty unique, but the way it mixes people up, I think, is also democratic.
Right. So after doing all this work, the book and the film, what does democracy mean to you?
Ooh, yeah. So I think democracy is a promise, going back to that. But I think it's not a promise that the powerful make and then break, right? We go, oh, you know, they're not doing our democracy for us. I really think it's a promise that can only be fulfilled by the people taking the time and thinking and acting, you know, and making it as real as it can be. And I don't think it can ever just be fulfilled. It's not something that we ever just grasp and then we get to just relax and tweak on the margins. I really think it's a perpetual struggle. So I think in the book, I'm like, yes, we had our founding fathers, but I think we need to be perennial midwives birthing this democracy into being.
Right. Well, that's a great message to end on, certainly in line with the theme of our show and kind of everything that we're trying to do with our podcast here. We're going to close, as we always do, with our four Mood of the Nation poll questions.
Ooh, I didn't know this.
So
I'm not ready.
We'll think of this like a lightning round. Four emotions, thinking specifically about American politics. So, again, thinking specifically about American politics, what makes you angry?
Oh, my God. What makes me angry? Isn't that funny? My mind is like, God, I feel like if I open the gate, there'll just be so many things. What makes me angry? Hubris.
What makes you proud?
Resistance.
What makes you worry?
Oh, climate change.
And what gives you hope?
The people.
All right. I think those might be our shortest answers ever. So you kept to the lightning round for sure. Thank you, Astra, so much for your time.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for the great questions.
All right. Well, there's a lot to chew on in that discussion. One thing that I thought was interesting and I thought really true is her argument that, what she said, that democracy means anything you want it to mean. And so you can have everybody from Kim Jong-un to the folks at Occupy Wall Street to George W. Bush all saying we're advancing democracy.
Well, you know, as we've discussed with some of our other guests, or certainly in our book review episode going back two full seasons.
That's
now,
right. Yeah.
You know, democracy can lead to very undemocratic sort of outcomes, or mm-hmm. at least democracy can lead to very illiberal sorts of outcomes. Democracy can lead to very authoritarian kinds of outcomes. So there's a lot wrapped up in these terms. It is difficult and a lot to expect of people on the street anyway to, you know, recognize that when you're talking about democracy and the idea that the people rule, you're not necessarily talking about, although you are in the American case, talking about the protection of rights and freedoms and minority rights as well, which are very much built into the American political system and are, you know, a reflection more of a small L liberalism mm-hmm. than they necessarily are of democracy.
No, that's clearly right. If you simply have democracy without any concern for the rights of the minority and the rights to say things that the majority doesn't like or believe what the majority doesn't want you to believe, without those rights, you know, Plato's argument is correct, that democracy is not sustainable, that it will inevitably lead to either anarchy or tyranny. And so, and that is exactly what we've said the founders were so concerned about. And so why there's a Bill of Rights, right? And why the courts are set up to defend those rights. Because if you leave it to, there's a point in the film where Cornel West is saying,
right,
you know, my rights as a black man are not because of democracy. They're because of the least democratic institutions in American society.
Right, indeed. I mean, when you look back at that period, you're at a time where African Americans had very few democratic rights. I mm-hmm. mean, their ability to vote was highly restricted. They had very little representation in any policymaking bodies
or
at all.
Or where they could live or what jobs they could. I mean,
but the American political system is set up with protections against democracy because those were democratic outcomes.
Exactly.
Those were democratic outcomes, but the American political system is set up with a counter-majoritarian court system, mm-hmm. you know, which ultimately overturned much of segregation through Brown and other court mm-hmm. decisions. The American political system is also set up with these protections for assembly and speech that allow for sort of social movements and protest and dissent outside of elected political bodies. And so there's a lot that goes beyond, you know, simple democratic rights in the American political system that can allow for actual freedom and for a just, more just outcomes.
So, yeah. So she mentioned—
democracy can lead to very unjust outcomes.
And without these— and the argument is that without these liberal— the bulwarks of liberalism, it inevitably will lead to those outcomes because people aren't naturally just. They aren't naturally, you know, accommodating to the minority point of view. And so it is only— – and so the point is that, you know, if you're going to say what's the difference between populism and democracy, or what's the difference between populism and a working democracy, it is the fact that these— – that populism is constrained, that the majority will is constrained, and you can't— – you know, you cannot decide everything by majority will.
Right. And populism also has this element of an us against them built into it,
mm-hmm.
which is— –
say more about that.
Which is highly divisive. And I mean, that's why populism can be on the left and the right.
And this idea of, you know, rising inequality is undermining democracy, that too is a theme that you know, you can trace throughout the history of America or of Western political thought. The idea that if you have wealthy people, if the wealthy just people just keep becoming wealthy, and the poor people just don't have any opportunity, even with democracy, to constrain that power, then democracy becomes either a sham or it descends into tyranny.
Yeah, I suppose. Although, you know, I think maybe it's a little bit more useful not to think of it in terms of wealthy people or not, but just the capital is very mobile in a global economy. And the very mobility of capital gives it a certain kind of power. And we saw this in the United States too. I mean, just think back to the, you know, the times when we had a really dominant sort of textile industry in New England or automobile
or
and steel industry.
And
these were relatively immobile sorts of economic enterprise. Mm-hmm. They needed to be where they were. And that gave political – that gave the people in those areas and politicians in those areas a certain amount of political leverage.
Mm-hmm.
They had to be there.
Right.
And this also, I think, allowed labor unions
right.
to grow very strong
and
in
good
these
jobs.
Areas. But it was when automobile industry, for example, learned that it could move out to Japan or down to the South, the same with the textile industry, could move off to Asia or down into, you know, South Carolina or something, or Latin America, then that mobility of capital gives it a certain kind of power over people and democratically elected leaders. Because you're all trying to get a hold of this mobile capital. I mean, just think about the kinds of offers that cities around the United States were making to try to get Amazon
mm-hmm.
when they said, you know, we're going to build a plant. And, you know, so when they're talking about offering tax breaks of different times, they're basically saying, well, we're going to do less in our public sector if that's what we need to do.
Right. Because
we need to get you here.
Right. We want you here.
We need what you're doing. We need the jobs that you're offering mm-hmm. and you're mobile and can go anywhere.
Right. Right.
And so that puts you in a strong position over us. And I think that's part of, you know, that starts to get at why this sort of global economy is such a challenge for democracy. Now, on the other side of it, it offers us tools for democracy, like social media, potentially, that we might not have had before.
Well, and it creates incredible wealth.
Yeah, so all valuable points. The movie raises all kinds mm-hmm. of all kinds of issues, many of which, you know, nice way to open the season.
Right.
Because lots of many issues which I know we're going to address in later podcasts during the season. For example, we're going to talk in some detail about inequality and where it comes from and why, at least in the American context, economic inequality and how that plays into political inequality.
And how it you know, how... how it sets the terms for a democratic society and you know, whether or not, you know, at some point inequality becomes so extreme that it makes it hard to sustain a democracy. What are those points? How do we identify them and what do we do about them? So this is a really good, you know, kind of entree into our season three, where we're laying out some big issues and we're once again reinforcing the idea that democracy is hard. It's not natural. It's not easy. And it really requires something of all of us if it's going to work well.
Yes. And what a great way to start our season with this film that gets right at right at some of the issues that the McCourtney Institute for Democracy is concerned about. What is democracy today?
Yeah. So, yeah, thanks to Jenna. Thanks to Astra for coming into campus and for showing her movie, being so generous with her time. And thanks to all you for listening. I'm Chris Beam.
I'm Michael Berkman.
And this is Democracy Works.
Democracy Works is produced by the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State and WPSU Penn State. Our hosts are Michael Berkman, Chris Beam, and me, Jenna Spinelli. Andy Grant is our engineer, and Mark Stitzer is our editor. Additional support comes from Emily Reddy, Shireen Stanford, Craig Johnson, and the rest of the team at WPSU. For detailed show notes and discussion questions for each episode, visit our website at democracyworkspodcast.com. And if you like what you heard today, please consider rating or reviewing us wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening.